Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. Yesterday, if you guys were paying attention, I just interviewed a guy named Jim Rogers, a Wall Street legend. He was telling me some of the ins and outs, and that's why I think this guest is absolutely perfect. Perfect timing. It's just very fortuitous for this to happen. And the book that we're going to be talking about is The Day the Markets Roared, How a 1982 Forecast Sparked a Global Bull Market. And we have an individual named David Cecilia, who is a part of this book. And it is an honor to have you here, sir. Thanks so much for being a part of Million Dollar Stories.
My pleasure.
Well, I'm looking at this book here, and it looks like it all started to get crazy right around August of 1982. And I was born in August of 84. So anything that's in August, I get excited for. So tell us a little bit about what happened and maybe the genesis about why you even wrote this book.
Sure. So you mentioned you had a guest on yesterday. It was a Wall Street legend. And
yeah. This
is a book about another Wall Street legend. I co-authored this with Dr. Henry Kaufman, who was probably the first person with a PhD to work on Wall Street. He started in the late 50s and really built his fame as head of research at Salomon Brothers through the late 60s, all through the 70s, up to 1988, and became arguably the most influential, certainly private economist in America, because he was watched, reported on daily, and sometimes his comments moved markets. The book focuses on an episode that happened on August 17th, 1982, when Dr. Kaufman issued a memo. It was a typed memo that his secretary distributed to Salomon Brothers clients. Later, the printed version would come out, but she issued it in the morning. And it led to the largest single bull market in American history since 1945 up to that time. And so the story is about how could a seemingly boring memo cause this massive bull market, both in the bonds and stock markets around the world. And so I'd be happy to go into either a little of the colorful detail of that day, but in order to understand why a memo would cause such a reaction, we circle back in the book and tell the story of where we were standing, where financial markets were standing on that day.
Beautiful. And it seems to be in alignment with one man can make a difference. Maybe this guy's word had so much weight that he could move mountains with it. And before we get into what was in that memo, can you tell us a little bit about his background of how he established such credibility and authority in the marketplace? You say he's one of the most famous economists in Wall Street. When I think of economists, I think of Milton Friedman or potentially even somebody I just interviewed today. I think it's Hayek, right? Friedrich Hayek, very well-known economist. What makes Henry Kaufman so significant? What did he do?
Well, he, we know that our Fed chairman can often have tremendous impact on financial markets. In fact, I did a book just on that topic regarding Alan Greenspan, who became a kind of rock star. But Henry Kaufman's a private individual. So there have been a number of occasions since that fateful day in 82 when the market has risen as much, but never caused by a pronouncement by a private individual. So the story really goes back. Henry Kaufman was born in Germany. He's a German Jew, by the way. He's still alive, 96 years old and doing well.
Wow.
And so his family, they had a kind of version of Kristallnacht in his village, and the Nazis busted into their home. No one was killed, but they fled to America. They were middle-class people. And Henry went to school at a high school in Washington Heights, which it turns out actually became a kind of breeding ground for great economists, because a year or two ahead of him, Alan Greenspan went to the same school, and Henry Kissinger went to the same school. But anyway, so Henry ended up wanting to be a doctor, didn't do so well in his organic chemistry. So he went into finance and eventually got a PhD from NYU and then started working in commercial banking for a couple of years. Spent about 2 years at the New York City Fed, which at that time, now we're into right around 1960, a kind of breeding ground for talent. So one day he was walking down the hall. Henry is not the tallest fellow. He's just a little over 5 feet tall. And here comes this guy, 6'8", chomping on a big cigar, and stops and says, "Oh, you're the new guy, Henry, right?" This was Paul Volcker, future Fed chairman. So that began a lifelong friendship. Anyway, so in 1962, Henry was recruited by Salomon Brothers, which was an investment house that specialized in bonds. And I should also note, you can tell from the name, this was a firm that was owned and founded by a Jewish family. And one reason Henry went there being Jewish is that, you know, even then there was enough anti-Semitism to keep him from being recruited by some of the other kind of white shoe firms on Wall Street. So at that time, there was a man there named Sidney Homer, who was an expert in the history of interest rates, which may not sound like a sexy topic, but
doesn't.
Read our book and, you know, the bond market, for instance, you know, doesn't get the kind of, you know, attention that the stock market does, but it's bigger and it's really exciting.
Commodities. People don't think that's exciting, right? But when you look into it, it's so much more meaningful than you ever realize. So yeah, I'm with you. Certain things that seem boring have a great impact on you.
That's right. So anyway, Sidney Homer started a research operation at Salomon Brothers, two economists, few assistants. If you fast forward to the late 80s, Sidney had long ago retired. There were 450 PhD economists, not all of them with PhDs, but 450 professional personnel. And Salomon Brothers had the best, most well-regarded fixed income research operation on the planet. Those of your listeners who may have read books like Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities may remember takes place these scenes of a bond trading room where these men are all screaming obscenities to each other and so on. That was based on the Salomon Brothers bond trading room, which was in a big building they had recently completed now into the 80s, at the end of very tip of Wall Street, one New York center. So anyway, through the 70s and through the 80s, Henry Kaufman developed some new ways of researching and forecasting the direction of interest rates. For those of you more technically oriented, this is became known as flow of funds analysis. And he became widely regarded as, of all the prognosticators out there and Fed watchers and so on, the most reliable, the most dependent. And so in many ways, he became the figurehead, even more than the president of Salomon Brothers, a guy named John Goodfriend, who passed away a few years ago, as the face of Salomon Brothers. So every day in the press, Henry Kaufman says this, Henry Kaufman says that, Henry Kaufman predicts this. And by the 70s and early 80s, some of these pronouncements start to have effects on the market. Now, the other piece of context here is that what is happening to interest rates and particularly to bonds from 1945 all the way until right around the time Henry Kaufman issues this memo, interest rates are going up. The cost of money is going up. This has a profound effect on economic activity. People, you know, buying, not just investing in bonds, but buying cars, buying houses, and everything. So the you know, the historic low was 2.5%, which was in 1945 for government long bonds. And that just climbed and climbed until a bit before our story here, October 81, when it hit a historical high of 15.25. So Jeez. You go from 2.5 to 15.25. And meanwhile, you know, the Reagan administration is in the 1980s, and its champions, you know, are touting Reaganomics. And here's Henry Kaufman, this, again, arguably most influential private sector economist in the United States, possibly the world, saying, well, I have concerns. You know, I don't think interest rates are going to be coming down anytime soon. And this earns him the title Dr. Doom. So when a whole bunch of economists, in fact, the majority, are saying, oh, well, you know, rates are going to come down and this is great and so on, here he is, the naysayer. But he's a really powerful naysayer, right? So
he was getting death threats. I was reading on your summary. Because of this, he's right. Getting death threats. Amazing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So there's, you know, some material in the book. We have a little fun. We talk about both the positive side and the dark side of his reputation. On the positive side, it becomes almost silly how revered this guy is and how followed he is. The New Yorker has cartoons about Henry Kaufman, the economist. People are putting on plays about him. People are writing. The famous journalist, from those of you a little bit older, Russell Baker, right? Syndicated humorist, Pulitzer Prize winner. He writes a whole big column about, you know, the life of Henry Kaufman. I have a little, you know, a little funny piece, if you don't mind, I'll read a couple sentences from Please. It just to give your readers a flavor. This appeared in a magazine called Province and in a story by a guy named Eric Nickel called A Life in the Day of Henry Kaufman. I rise, this is Kaufman, fictional portrayal. I rise early, wakened by a beam of light from heaven that shines directly, but with respect, into my eyes. I go to the bathroom like other mortals, except, of course, that when I flush the toilet, it activates 2,700 computers on the stock exchanges of the world. I breakfast simply, a little milk and honey with pomegranates and myrrh and aloes, with all the chief spices. My breath alone is enough to raise AT&T 10 points. So, and so on and so forth throughout his day. So that kind of gives you a flavor of it, right?
Wow.
But at the same time, as you point out, some people, certainly fans of the Reagan administration policies, are really angry. There's a guy at the New York Post who gives Henry Kaufman the moniker Dr. Doom and is highly critical of him. And a guy traced back to the Chicago Board of Trade phones in death threats because Kaufman caused markets to go down. And he lost them a lot of money. So for a while, Solomon Brothers assigned a bodyguard to follow Henry Kaufman around and actually live in his house. And he told them things like, you should walk down the middle of the sidewalk when you're walking in New York. It's easier to avoid getting kidnapped that way.
Oh, you know, my God.
Like that. So anyway.
Wow. He became infamous, is what you're saying.
He became very infamous. And so those two things, right, are what set the context for why this memo had such an important effect, which is that for decades, interest rates are going up and Wall Street is just eagerly awaiting the turnaround. This, when you have a big movement like this, known as a secular trend on Wall Street. So there's kind of the signal and the noise, and this is the signal.
And so just to give our audience some type of context here, the reason why interest rates were so high was to combat what, stagflation, right? And that's what Reaganomics was doing. Is that right? I think because there was so much of a, I don't know, LBJ or what it was happening in the 70s, so much of printing of money, they had to fight it some way. And that's why the interest rates were so high. Do you know any details that you can share with our audience?
Sure. I mean, inflation really started to get out of control in the mid 60s because the economy was already running at near full capacity. And President Lyndon Baines Johnson wanted to conduct the Vietnam War. The 65s, the year really scaled up, but he was also building his big Great Society programs, a lot of spending there.
Yep.
So this caused rates to start to go up. We also have a series of Fed chairmen who aren't able to really rein in inflation for years. So once that happens, it gets kind of baked into expectations, and it's really hard to bring it down. The guy, the real champion from the perspective of the Fed, was Henry's friend, Paul Volcker, who comes in the late 70s under Jimmy Carter, gets reappointed by Reagan, and really bites the bullet. He switched to a monetarist kind of stance, and it brings on a recession, which became known as the Reagan recession, but it does finally wring inflation out of the economy. So, you know, of course, Kaufman and all economists are watching this. So, so it turns out that the secular trend, which is looking at this big curve, really happened in late 81, but there's a lot of noise in there. There's daily little mini bull markets and stuff like that. So Henry's on vacation in Madeira, Portugal with his wife, but he's like, something's bothering me here. I feel like, you know, all the things he's watching are starting to paint a little bit of a different picture. So he goes back to the States, goes back, does some more research, and then decides to change his stance. And so he has a secretary type up this memo and send it to, you know, his firm's clients. And then that morning, the morning of August 17th, 1982, the Salomon Brothers Executive Committee held its meetings in the Waldorf Astoria in Midtown Manhattan to kind of get out of the whole crazy trading floor environment. So they go in, they start to have their meeting, and the phone rings. It's Henry's secretary. She says, you know, I really need to talk to him. They hate to have this meeting interrupted, but he has to step out. And he's gone for a good 5 or 10 minutes. He comes in and everyone's giving him a dirty look. John Goodfriend, the senior partner, says, Henry, you know, you kept us waiting here. What's going on? And he said, well, the markets are really going crazy. And then they talk a little more. More phone calls come in. And then somebody says, what's going on in the markets? And the answer from their headquarters in Lower Manhattan is Henry's memo. So they all look at him and they go, what's this? What are they talking about? What's with this memo? And he said, well, you know, in my usual memo this morning, I predicted that over the next 10 months, long-term bonds would fall from 12.75 to the 9 or 10% range, and the federal funds rate would fall from 10% down to the sort of 6 to 7% range. So this is saying, here's Dr. Doom for decades. Oh,
changing his mind, starting to almost shine the sunshine on everything, probably exactly. Waking people up.
Exactly.
Got it.
So after decades of all these people saying, oh, we think things are better, we think things are going to be better, this and that, finally, Dr. Doom changes his mind. So they're like, what? You know, you said what? And because they didn't know. And this is one of the things, I've worked with Dr. Kaufman for 25 years, one of the things I really respect about him the most You know, you could, this was research that was done internally, right? And, but the policy at Salomon Brothers and Henry Kaufman's practice was to let the clients know at the same time he lets the inside people, all of their traders, know what he's going to say, because they could have profited a lot off of, you know, getting the jump on this news. So the board, the executive committee at Salomon Brothers is actually hearing the news of the great Henry Kaufman changing his position after the firm's own clients. Wow. And that's pretty remarkable. I don't know that you would see those kind of firewalls in today's environment. So what happens is by the end of that day, the Dow closes up just under 5%. And, you know, it closed at 8:31, and it was a, I need to put this in perspective, because this means that in today's environment, where the Dow's hovering around 40,000, right? This would mean a single day rise of about 2,000 points. So this is, as I said, the largest gain since the end of World War II.
Unbelievable.
Standard & Poor's is up almost as much. There's a massive bond rally. Prices skyrocket. Interest rates are falling. Most short-term rates on most rates on short-term bonds fall about a half a point in a single day. And it does kind of continue on. I'll just give you one more statistic. By August 23rd, so just about a week later, the Standard & Poor's peaked 14.5% higher than on where it was on the eve of Henry Kaufman's pronouncement. So this goes viral, and
headlines, right? I would really love for you to share, if you have the stats on this, how much wealth was created in a 12-hour period because of a memo. I mean, it's got to be in the, I mean, I don't know. Do you have the numbers on that?
Unfortunately, I do not. I haven't made those calculations.
Think about that, right? The amount of wealth that was created, maybe it's only in 8 hours, but oh my God.
Absolutely.
Oh my God. So,
and then, you know, then comes the wave where every business journalist in the world wants an interview with Henry Kaufman, right? So they had a man named Mel Adams, who had a PR firm who kind of handled that sort of thing, setting up interviews. And we found this great memo. I'm a financial historian, and this is the kind of thing like gold, you know. It's like, wow, look at this memo, which shows that in the wake of this crazy day, they got the 74 print journalists who worked at more than 50 outlets asked for interviews, and 65 TV and radio journalists from around the world working at 38 networks asked to interview Henry Kaufman. And we have the list of who all of them were. So anybody in business journalism in the world wants to talk to Henry Kaufman at that point.
So what happened then? So all of this optimism lended favor to Wall Street. What happened to the interest rates? Did they start to creep down because of this?
So the interest rates start to go down. And so we had this, you know, think of a mountain. So one side of the mountain, interest rates are going up from 1945 to late 81, early 82, mid 82. And then they start to fall, and they continue to fall until we get to that historically low level that we hit a few years ago, right around the time of
what was
COVID.
It 2%, something like 1.1 points,
yeah,
something like that, yeah,
exactly, one lower than 2%, I think. So it's not as if, you know, it's not as if Henry Kaufman's pronouncements caused that to happen, although it certainly reinforced the trend. It's that he identified that it was going to happen. And there's one other economist who did that as well. I might say a word or two about, but it's that the world believed that we had turned the corner only when Henry Kaufman said so.
Unbelievable, the power of one man's voice, or maybe the fact that it was just timing, where there was people were waiting for some of the doomsday individuals to kind of turn their corner, and they said, okay, as soon as we got them on board, such as a Kaufman, then it's we're really out of the woods. It's pretty
wild. Yeah, I think
wild.
You're really on to it, because, you know, lots and lots of people wanted to believe we had turned the corner, but it wasn't until the great naysayer, Dr. Doom, said so. And of course, he had the credibility. So, you know, a lot of his career, and one of the big lessons that comes out of this story, is that, you know, it's really hard to go against the tide. There's not a lot of benefits to being the outlier. It's a right. pretty risky thing. But he was always willing to do that, and it did earn him the street cred throughout the Wall Street community. I mean, he was highly regarded and highly followed. I don't think we've seen a single individual. Kaufman retired from Salmon Brothers in 88, just as a little sidebar, because he was concerned about the kind of risks that the firm was starting to take. And it turns out that he was right about that, too, because a few years later, Salmon Brothers got into a lot of trouble and actually went bankrupt and was taken over. And so, being willing and able to go against the tide and to just talk about what the data were showing, no matter how unpopular, earned him that credibility.
Man, Reagan probably hated him and then turned out to absolutely love him, probably, right? Because it really reflected on Reagan more than anything, I would think. But how long did this bull market last? Was it up until 87 crash? Did it keep going, keep getting better?
The bull market on Wall Street. Yeah, I mean, we had the big incident with Alan Greenspan. Basically, the big trend is, so again, the interest rate trend was just pretty steadily down until just a few years ago. The Wall Street, of course, gone up and down, but the two big outstanding trends were the so-called dot-com bubble, which burst right around 2000, and then the 2008 housing crisis-driven bubble.
Yeah,
but you know, if you look at those trends, the markets, gained a lot before, and they lost a lot during those panics, and then they recovered to the sort of same trend line that you would see if you had projected ahead without those two big events in there. If I'm being clear, so you have an overall trend line, then you have this kind of big upward surge during the bubble, a big correction, and then you return to that same upward trend line. And that's true in the case of both of those Dow disruptions.
So one of the great takeaways, like you just said, is that if you have backbone and you fight against the current, you might not be liked, but you'll be respected. So whenever you say something, people listen. And whenever you're on the same side, people really admire you. And so, you know, going against the current might not get you a lot of favor, but it will earn you respect and authority in the marketplace. And maybe that's the great takeaway of Kaufman's life.
I think that you've put it really well.
So what do you think? And maybe you've talked to him recently, or maybe you just kind of know the inside track. What is he thinking of today's market? Is he a little bit nervous of where this country's going and what's happening? I mean, we got the Dow up, I think, was it 38,000? I haven't looked at it, but I attribute that to just printing of money, you know, inflation. So what is he thinking, or what are you seeing, or what do you believe he would even think if you kind of know his mind?
So, you know, this is the thing that people always want to talk to him about. I know that he, you know, he doesn't have available to him the kind of data streams that he did when he was working at Salomon Brothers And again, you know, they pioneered a new kind of analysis called flow of funds analysis that really gained enormous traction. So I talked to him a lot. I talked to him yesterday. We did not talk about what he's thinking about markets right now. And I think he would probably be reluctant to make any sort of predictions because he doesn't have all of that data available. I mean, the Federal Reserve, when I did my book about Greenspan, I learned that, you know, they have available to them 5,000 streams of data, everything from, you know, trends in pork belly futures in Cincinnati to plywood orders in Oklahoma. And so there's a lot of noise there, but the art is to see the signal in the noise. And that's what the Fed tries to do. And that's what Henry was especially good at doing.
Now, you say you are an economics historian, it sounds like, right? You do this a lot. So what got you into this world? What made you fall in love with maybe researching great Wall Street magicians or just economists?
Yeah, so I started off, you know, in getting my PhD in American history, and then I sort of quickly realized that we are the most business-oriented society on Earth. I mean, you could argue that maybe Hong Kong's a little more purely capitalist, but, you know, we're a big, powerful, still the biggest economy in the world. So in order to understand American history, you have to understand American business history. And I also had a mentor at Hofstra University named Robert Sobel, who was a financial historian. It was actually, he ended up writing about 30 books about the history of Wall Street. So for me, this has been where it's at for over 30 years.
So it's in your blood. You learn from people who just kind of oozed it out then. That's interesting. Hofstra, is that New York? That's New York, right?
That's in Hempstead, New York. Yes.
Right. I used to play hockey. We used to go against Hofstra there. It's okay. Always a bloodbath against them. So that's why it always sticks out in my brain. That's outside of your book or maybe some of the books. I don't know if we mentioned anything in this podcast, but is there a book that stands out in your life that was a defining moment, maybe got you to fall in love with economics or, you know, Wall Street or anything like that? Rich Dad, Poor Dad is a book that stands out in my life. And I always bring that up because I wouldn't be here without it. Is there any book like that for you?
Well, I had the pleasure of working with a man named Alfred Chandler, who was at the Harvard Business School. I went to Brandeis, but he took me on as his PhD advisee, who became the most influential business historian in the world. He wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book called The Visible Hand. And I would say that book has shaped the perspective of, you know, a whole generation of people. And really what he's arguing, you may kind of recognize the phrase, the invisible hand.
That's what I wrote it down. I've never heard of the visible hand. So I wrote that down to check it out. But the invisible hand, right? It's, I mean, we've all heard that from history class, right?
Adam Smith. So Adam Smith taught us that, you know, in a capitalist society, the forces of supply and demand cause millions and millions of decisions to be made about what to make, what to invest in, quality of goods, and so on, in a way that almost seems miraculous, but it's the impersonal forces of the marketplace being carried out by individuals that cause capitalist economies to thrive. Now, Chandler wouldn't disagree with any of that, but what he adds to the story is that in the modern period, really starting in the middle of the 19th century, we get this new class of economic actors, professional managers, and they build these giant firms, typically vertically integrated firms that exercise enormous market power, and they make decisions about what to produce and where to distribute it and what quality and so on. And that has a profound effect. This gives us something called managerial capitalism. So we now have this kind of dual economy where most firms still live in the world of Adam Smith, right? They're small. They don't have the power to affect prices or anything like that. But then in the middle, we have these giant corporations where the professional managers do make decisions that shape the largest firms and the largest sectors in advanced economies. So that's a book I would recommend again. And, you know, Chandler tried to make bureaucracy sexy because, you know, it's not a topic most of us think of as being particularly interesting. And we, most of us have kind of a negative view of bureaucracy. But in fact, if big corporations make the wrong decisions about how to structure their firms, whether to have a multi-divisional structure, say, or a unified structure, they can destroy the whole firm. So these middle managers are the driving force in our core economy.
Yeah. Yeah, the more you understand economics, you realize, I mean, BlackRock, just how much power they have over things that you don't even realize they're touching, right? I mean, I think they own 60% of percentage of at least 60 to 70% of the S&P 500. Now think about the power Larry Fink has and people like him. Yeah. So yeah, I'm an Adam Smith guy. I love the free market. I love capitalism, but we're living in a world where it's not just free market. There's a lot of bureaucracy and many people say crony capitalism. So you just got to see the game for what it is and then play your hand accordingly. So I'm going to check out that book. Right. I've never heard of it, sir. That's good. Good suggestion.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say, you know, one more thing about Dr. Kaufman's career. He's written several books. I worked on four of them with him. And one theme that he's talked about for decades is the growing concentration in the financial sector. So if you go back just to 1980, you see there were a whole, you know, dozen or two dozen large financial institutions. Now there are four. And those four control over 80% of all the assets under management. So it's highly, highly concentrated. And Dr. Kaufman has admonished, you know, not for the good. This is making our financial markets less competitiveness. And they've become, of course, these financial supermarkets, right? So when he started his career and really got going, you had to have, you know, commercial banks, investment banks, insurance companies, credit card companies, and on had to be separate companies. Now they're allowed to merge together. And they claim that there are benefits for the consumer of that, but I think actually it's not a very good trend. There's a lot of conflicts of interest that inevitably arise when you have one firm that's, you know, on both sides of the trade effectively, and they may even offer the consulting services to your firm. So they're investing their own money and they're investing your money, right? And how is that not a conflict of interest?
Of course. Yeah.
So this is why we mentioned Paul Volcker. This is why, you know, I think he's the greatest Fed chairman in the history of the institution for wringing inflation out of the economy. But also in his later career, he pushed for something called the Volcker Rule, which was intended to prevent firms that were the fiduciary agency for investors' money from investing their own money. And, you know, it just seems like common sense to me that you.
Yeah, that's what I would think, too. Yeah. Oh, I got to check that. The Volcker Rule, is that what he called it?
Yes.
Yeah, I got to check that out. I don't know anything about Volcker. I've never heard that. I don't know much about his history, but I'm going to look into it. Another thing I want to look into, and guys, if you're out there listening, you will love entrepreneurship as much as I do. One of his books from 1986 called The Entrepreneurs, An American Adventure. It is only on hardcover. I was hoping it was on audiobook because I would listen to that right away. But I'm going to check this out. I love learning about P.T. Barnum, and I'm looking at some of the other names here. I don't even know these people, but I'm going to check this out. Is that your first book?
It was, and I had the pleasure of co-authoring it with that professor at Hofstra I mentioned. They then made a national TV miniseries out of it, narrated by Robert Mitchum, who some of your older listeners may remember, a great Hollywood actor. So it was a six-part miniseries as well. And we just looked at, you know, every business sector and looked at, you know, some women entrepreneurs and so on, and just told stories of how they did it.
And Lydia Pinkham, wish we had time to go into that individual's past, but selling home remedies for lonely women. I got to look up this person because I just love understanding how some entrepreneurs think, the psychology behind why certain, you know, people make decisions and how they come across those solutions. So, man, I'm going to look into this book, but Entrepreneurs, An American Adventure, guys, if you want to pull it up on Amazon. And David has many books. So Labors of Modern Hercules, The Engine That Could. There are many. Pull it up. But the one we talked about today is with Henry Kaufman, and that is the Day the Markets Roared. And I like how it's the minute by minute a documentation of one day that sparked a global bull market. So pretty cool to learn from you on this, and I really appreciate your time today, sir.
Well, thank you. Thanks for your great questions. And you know, any of your folks in your audience can easily find me. Just Google me. I'm at the University of Maryland.
Beautiful. Are you on social media? Is there a channel that you like to post on more than anything else?
Nope. Okay. But, you know, we have your podcast out there. So why would someone need anything else? Why would we need this TikTok and Facebook stuff, you know?
Just do the podcast. I'm with you. I've been saying this for at least a year now. Just listen to the podcast. You'll get everything you need. But you can Google David Cecilia. He's easy to find. And yes, thanks so much. I really appreciate your time, man. Guys, check out his books, read them, and you'll learn more about great, great people in our past. Remember, a $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.